You're listening to The Voice of the Caribbean Radio, your source for news, sports, and entertainment in the Caribbean.
This is Let's Talk St. Kitts Nevis here on Voice of the Caribbean Radio at voiceofthecaribbean.net. I'm your host, Andre Huey. Today's program will be exclusively on an interview that we had with the Prime Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis, Dr. Terence Drew. This was the second interview that we've had with him through our sister media entity, SKN Newsline, that was held some weeks back. And he touched on very pertinent issues, some of which are still pertinent at the moment. So we'll present you an interview with Dr. Terence Drew, Prime Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis, on the entire edition of our program for today. But before that, we'll take a break and be right back.
Voice of the Caribbean Radio, VOC Radio. Stay locked on.
Online radio has never been this great. It's Voice of the Caribbean Radio at voiceofthecaribbean.net. Tune into Voice of the Caribbean Radio for great Caribbean programs, news, entertainment, sports, and current affairs. Wake up each morning and be inspired with One Day at a Time with Kim Huey. Stay abreast with news across the Caribbean and internationally with the Caribbean News Hour, and be entertained with shows like Reggaeville, Caribbean Classics, and Jive Music Show. Visit our website, download our Android mobile app, or listen us on TuneIn Radio. There is so much more on Voice of the Caribbean Radio, reaching the Caribbean and beyond. Check website or app for program schedule.
Welcome back to Let's Talk St. Kitts Nevis. As promised, we'll head into that interview we had with Dr. Terence Drew. The interview was first aired on SKN Newsline, or sister news service, sknewsline.com in St. Kitts and Nevis. And the Prime Minister spoke on a wide range of issues. We'll get into that interview right about now.
Well, we have really sought to fulfill a number of critical commitments that we would have made to the people, and would have said that we would deal with them as soon as we were to get into office. We are now in office and we have dealt with them. Mm-hmm. One of the first things that we did was to really lift the travel protocol with respect to the COVID-19. And persons are allowed to travel to St. Kitts and Nevis. And we recognize that the scientific data suggested that we did not even need to test those who were coming into our country, because our immunity was strong enough to resist. And so that is a good sign. And so it gave us that opportunity. But I had known for some time, even during the campaign, that the data existed. Mm-hmm. When I got there, I found out that the administration was being advised to at least loosen the restrictions since May. Mm-hmm. And the Prime Minister then did not follow the advice. Mm-hmm. And so, as I said, I took a prudent decision based on scientific information, and so I was able, with my team, to lift those travel protocol. But that has gone further, because as the data came in, we recognized we could have also gotten rid of the mask mandate. So the mask mandate is also lifted, and it's lifted except for health institutions. And so that is why you see that the number of persons were able to have their activities, right, the activity in Newtown, the jam session that they had, right, because the data suggests that we can go back to those type of activities.
So he said, with the exception of health institutions, which means if you go to the hospital, you may still have to wear masks.
Yes, you will still have to wear masks. And so we'll monitor it accordingly and decide when all can be lifted. But I think in a health institution, it's prudent to do that nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And so the people, I think, are enjoying their freedom. Mm-hmm. I remember when, just after we made that policy, and I would be at a hotel or some sort of, you know, restaurant, I had tourists coming up to me and saying thank you. Mm-hmm. And I did not realize that is what they were saying thank you for.
Right.
And so we dealt with those things very quickly, so that they, and that is why we're able to say to the world that we are once again open up for business. And this would have a positive impact in the tourism industry, as people can now travel more freely. St. Kitts will now become a good option, and that will drive the economy in that particular sector.
Right. Now, as you, we're going to talk more about some, well, you could
right,
refer
so
to
the other ones, yes. Quickly, we were also able to deal with the gratuitous payment for those persons who were terminated because they did not take the COVID vaccine. And the persons who we specify are those who actually made a formal complaint to the Labor Department and would have had their situation looked at. Mm-hmm. And so we have already made that decision for them. The other one is the honorarium. Mm-hmm. We made the commitment that we will give an honorarium to the frontline workers, and we have also done that in cabinet as well. We went further.
Before you go further,
yes.
Is that based on the amounts vary, and is that based on how much work those frontline workers or risk they would be taking?
Basically? Right. So basically, it is is across the board. Mm-hmm. We have the definition of who a frontline worker was.
Right.
Or is, because the process is still winding down, and those persons who fit that definition would get the honorarium. Now, we are looking at it to make it something across the board flat. Now, the reason why we said that the honorarium should be given, even during the election, I'm sure that persons would have remembered when I said at some point that those who are at risk should be given some sort of compensation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was said, what am I talking about? This is country above self, all those type of terms and words were used as if to make me look bad, but only to find out after that persons had received significant amount as an honorarium. And I think at that point, people lost confidence and faith, a lot of faith in those who were really talking about country above self and as if they had not received anything.
And will the honorarium for frontline workers be anything close to what?
Right, so you can see some people receive higher amounts on a graded platform. We will give, of course, much more persons, and so we'll make it most likely a flat rate across the board, because those on the front line or frontline workers, their risk is what determines that they should get it. There are those who may have worked overtime and so forth, but that has nothing to do with their risk in facing a disease. For example, you have the cleaners at the hospital, the environmental workers who would have been in contact with maybe, you know, COVID in different ways, they too must be considered. So it's not just healthcare workers or forces who are on the front line, but others who work in institutions who are on front line that they deserve as well and would get as well. So it's a much larger number, and we'll make it across the board that those who are within the definition of frontline worker would get, of course. And that is another one that we dealt with. We also dealt with making the CFBC free, tuition free. That was one of the first things that we passed. So students can go to a CFBC without cost. And surprisingly enough, it only cost us about $1 million per year, or to $1 million to $1.5 million per year to send our students to CFBC for free. And that is in keeping with our policy to educate our people very well and to remove as many barriers as possible to education. We also put in place payments for students who go, economic cost payments for all students who go to University of the West Indies. I know that many could not go. Many had problems going because they had stopped economic costs for certain areas such as medicine and law. What we recognize, what that would do, is that if you had a child who was very talented and bright, but his mother or father could not afford to send him to UWE to pursue medicine or law, he would have never gotten the opportunity. So we would have gone back to the old days of selecting only those who had economic means of pursuing medicine and law and so forth. So we have moved that out. We might look at it closer and make sure we get those who are the best, irrespective of their economic situation or financial situation, so that they can get to university. So we want to really get our people to university, because the aim is to get at least 25% of our population university educated. And so we'll put policies in place, of course, practical policies and looking at the realities, but our goal is to get there. So these were two significant steps that we would have taken that would have gotten us there. The other thing was in terms of the laptop program. We have also started to move to put the laptop program back in place. Why? Because we want our students to have access to technology, so that as they educate themselves, they are left behind. They can compete, as we said before, with those in China, India, and across the world, Western Europe, and so forth. Even though we are small, we believe we can educate our people to compete anywhere in the world.
And these are primary school students that will be getting
right. So we're going to start with the high schoolers. As we phase it back in, those in fifth form right now, we're going to do CXC. And as we go along, we start phasing it in. And we're going to go as far as the primary school. The other thing that we're going to do in education is what you call e-education, where we want to go. We're already laying, or we're going to lay the fiber optic lines to connect the schools and so forth, so that they can have good access to internet and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so that teachers would also be given the opportunity to have laptops. And so we want to introduce smart boards and so that we can really take the education to the next level. So we are going to be investing in education as well.
On that point of the laptop program, one of the major criticisms of the program previously was that there wasn't a proper supervision. The students got the laptops, they didn't take care of them, and they weren't using them most of the time for school work. How would you ensure this time around that the program is more effective in terms of how it's conducted?
Well, I cannot say that most of the time it was not being used for schoolwork. That might have been said to justify ending the program. But like any other new program, it was not a perfect program, but it was a good program.
Right.
So all that needed to be done was to, where there were issues, you could fix them, but you shouldn't just throw out the whole program. Mm-hmm. So we have picked up that there would have been issues. And when the program is reintroduced, there will be, of course, a plan to deal with those issues. But also, new issues will arise. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean we should take the technology from the students.
Right.
When you go to the most developed countries, the students have, technology has become just the norm for them. If we don't get to that state here in St. Kitts and Nevis, we will be left behind. Mm-hmm. And we are determined in this government not to be left behind and not to leave our students and our people behind.
Right. The transition process, how is that going?
Well, I think that the transition process has been going quite well. I think that people recognize that the country changed administration, but there were no major upheaval in terms of stopping the economy, stopping people's lives. And I think that we're able to get in and start to make changes in a way, in a smooth way, that would allow the country to continue to say to the world that we are a country, we are a democratic country, we are politically stable, that even when there's a change in administration, that the government continues to run smoothly. That is what we want to send. Others had a different approach, and we see what that resulted in. We, in the Labour Party, our approach is not such. It has never been. So with respect to our transition, it has been smooth. We have come in. We have treated people with respect and dignity. Even those who are politically appointed, they know that they are politically appointed, and they have been given the dignified space to make the honorable decision. They know that they have been politically appointed and they should resign their position. In the United States, there are about 4,500 politically appointed positions. As soon as the elections are over, those people send in their resignation because they understand a new administration is in to ease the transition. This is the honorable thing to do. If their services are needed, they will be asked by the new administration to apply or to stay on.
And by political appointment, you're referring to specific positions, or are you referring to persons who is probably known by many people as supporters of that particular party that was placed in that position because of their affiliation?
Right. So there are particular politically appointed positions, and persons know who they are and why they were appointed in that particular position. So it's a mixture of both. Then, right? But there are some, of course, well-known politically appointed positions, such as advisors, ambassadors, and so forth. They know that these are politically appointed positions. I am saying to my people who have been appointed and who I will appoint that this is a politically appointed position. If there's a change in administration, you know that when I go, you go. And if the new administration wants you, then they would ask for you. And I think that there was a tape of Timothy Harris when he came into office about 5 years ago, well, 7 years ago. He made a tape and said that those who are politically appointed should do that. So I think that he would have informed his people that you are being politically appointed and that on change of administration, you are expected to resign and give the new administration a chance. And if your services are needed, you will be asked to hold on or reapply. And so we are looking at that. So we are now in the process where we have given people opportunity and space. When we got into office, we went to government headquarters. Unlike them who went into people's offices, ransack offices. People had on hard hats as if this was some sort of rogue country, banana republic. That is not how you transition a government. We were determined, and I want to thank the supporters of the St. Kitts Nevis Labour Party and those who voted for us, who came out in their large numbers, for not violating the sanctity of the government headquarters. They respected it, respected those who were there, and respected the offices. And that is the type of paradigm shift that I wanted our administration at this time to put forward. But still, I'm saying that there are those who are still in politically appointed position that they really should do the honorable thing. But we will make the decisions. As we now have seen, you say after a month, people would have been given that chance to resign, to put their things in order and so forth. And so we are at the point where, for those who have not, we will have to kindly ask them that they resign. And I have started that already. For example, actions were taken with respect to our administration, with respect to National Bank. It will be taken to Development Bank, Social Security,
and so the board as well.
The board as well, because they know the board as well, so that we can start in earnest to entrench the government, the administration, so that we can start moving the country forward. Because people voted for a particular type of governance, they voted for policies, and they expect this administration to implement those. And so they understand that we have our persons who we want to put in particular positions to carry out those policies. That is just part of the normal political process. So that is the approach we are taking. And so we will start to do exactly what, and we have started, but we have been doing it in a decent, honorable way.
On that note, though, Prime Minister, there are some, maybe supporters also of the Labour Party, who say, well, the process is moving too slow. Doctor, you need to get rid of certain people, and you need to move the process a bit faster, because previously that was probably what was done, and so they expect that that should follow suit.
Right.
So you have, and this in, at the same time, while you're trying to bring in a new paradigm, you have maybe some disgruntled supporters who are saying you need to act fast.
Right, so I know that there would be those who might have a different position as us, and that is fine. This is a democratic country, and they should be given the opportunity to express themselves. I think you said the government is about just about a month.
Right.
That's what, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, a very, very, very short time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
5 weeks of how many weeks? 52 times five. Yes, these are very, very short time. So I think that in the transition, you know, the new administration should be given some space. And I ask people to, you know, be patient with the administration as we seek to do things, because we are installing a government, an administration, to last a very long time. Yeah. And so we have to get it right. I think even though people might have a different opinion with the speed at which things are happening, I think many of them, when they see who we are selecting, who we are putting in position, they would recognize quickly that this is a very prudent, deliberate type of action that is being taken to make sure that we install a government that can deliver for the people. So I ask the people for patience. It's been a very short, relatively short time. In the next few weeks, we will, of course, install the administration that is needed to really implement the policies and plans that people voted for. But we will do it decently, we will do it respectfully, and I'm still saying to some of those who are politically appointed to do the honorable thing. But notwithstanding that, I think people would have been given enough time to make that decision, and we will make sure that we do what we have to do. But we will not practice victimization. There's a difference between installing an administration and asking those politically appointed people that to resign, they know who they are. Or we will have to reposition people as well, because that is part of the political process, to make sure that we have the right people in the right places to implement the policies and plans. But we will not tag people and victimize people and treat people dishonorably and treat people as less than their citizens. That will not happen under our watch. But at the same time, I say again, we know that we have to move people, and some people would have to resign and so forth as we move forward.
Let's shift our attentions a bit. We're into one of, if you want to call it, a major decision by your government, which was to respect the ruling of the court as it relates to marijuana cultivating and use in private settings. We know that court, that famous court case a few years back with Raskan Sankofa, and the Attorney General had essentially said that the police have been instructed to follow the orders laid out by the court where that is concerned. Is this the first step in the creation of the medical marijuana, which of course you campaigned on while campaigning during the elections? And how fast or how soon could we see that medical marijuana industry being developed?
Right. Very good question. Well, first of all, we want to, the rule of law, and I've always spoken about the rule of law. If there's no rule of law, no country, no democracy can exist. It is that serious. It is the rule of law that determines whether you have a stable country, whether you have a democratic country or not. Mm-hmm. And so the law is clear, the ruling is clear with respect to having marijuana in your privacy. That has been done. And so what the AG is saying is that we have to respect the law. And that is what we are going to do as an administration. But with respect to marijuana, we are behind. Why are we behind? I don't know if you know, but we send workers from St. Kitts and Nevis to Canada to work on marijuana plantations. They actually work on marijuana
on the farm work program.
And the farm work program. We send them. So why would we send them to Canada to help to advance the Canada's industry, the Canadian industry, for them to, of course, earn the big part of the market? We need that as well.
But one of the challenges, though, Dr. Drew, and as you rightly pointed out, St. Kitts and Nevis is behind in that respect.
Very much behind.
The developed countries, however, and we know we've had situations in the past where developed countries tend to set up roadblocks for smaller countries, smaller developing countries, to advance in certain areas. And this may just be one of them.
Right. So we have to be mindful of that. And we have to be careful that we don't make the mistake of being left behind. And so that has been done. We have a marijuana commission in place. That commission would start functioning in earnest to get us there. We will then move also to expunge the records of those who have criminal records for possession of marijuana. We think that that should not be used as a means to limit people's advancement in their own lives. And so we will put the necessary legislation in place to get us there. Antigua is ahead. St. Vincent is ahead. Jamaica is ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, and we know that people travel to this country because they would have an industry that is well controlled, well monitored, and so forth, that allow the use of marijuana. And so we will be on that path. So we'll see a lot of action in that area within the first year.
Right. And what measures are being put in place to ensure that local farmers and local people have the great advantage, so to speak? Because normally we have foreign investment coming in and it doesn't measure up in terms of the locals benefiting.
Well, at this point in time, we are not looking at any outside people necessarily coming in and dominating this industry. Mm-hmm. This industry is for our people to develop. We will not make that mistake. And therefore, we will, of course, meet those who are involved in the industry, and we will work out ways of how we can make sure that they are part of the industry. I know in other regions, when you have the cafes and so forth, or even the marijuana for that use, you have to buy from the local farmers. They have to get their fair share of the market. But I would say at this time, the goal is, and what we will do, is to make sure that the local growers are protected, our people are protected within that industry.
Before we move on from this point of marijuana, you're also the Minister of National Security.
Yes.
The law, or at least the respect from the court, or the ruling from the court, is such that in your private setting, you can utilize marijuana for religious purposes, etc. But you do have the issue of other people who may not be marijuana smokers, who may not be engaged in that at all, who may be affected. And somehow, some people might feel that this ruling gives them the freedom to smoke wherever, do whatever they want. Could you speak to that?
Right.
That
I don't think the ruling speaks to that at all.
Right. It doesn't. Some people might think that it does.
Yes, good. Yes. So for those who have that impression, I would like them to become au fait with the law and understand that the law does not say you can just walk down the road burning a spliff, as we say in local parlance here. We would say that those who are the users, and if you're going to smoke it, it gives you in your privacy of your home. And that is what really should happen. It should be in the privacy of your quarters. And there's nothing that gives you the right to be out on the street and so forth. And we are saying to people, even if you have the right not to abuse, to be mindful of how it is used. Just like alcohol is legal here in St. Kitts and Nevis, you're allowed to use it even in public. Mm-hmm. But you still want to tell people to be mindful, to use it properly. You still should not drink and drive, and that is against the law. Mm-hmm. So even though the law allows you in your privacy of your home, we're still asking people to be prudent and mindful of how they use it.
Segue into the economy, looking at matters of the economy. In an interview I had recently with a local economist, he suggested that the government needs to establish a developmental plan to grow the economy and to create opportunities for people, transfer of wealth and all these things.
Yes.
Have you begun crafting a developmental plan for the economy?
We started even before the elections. Mm-hmm. For example, I spoke of an economic council. I still have that economic council, mm-hmm. and we have formalized it. That economic council is to do exactly what you are saying, mm-hmm. to make sure that we have that developmental plan and the strategy of implementation as well. So yes, we have started in earnest to make sure. Because for example, our economy, the last administration brought the economy to depend heavily on the CBI program. We have to look to diversify the economy. Mm-hmm. So that is a part of the economy and that we don't depend on that as heavily as we are right now. The transfer, the wealth aspect that he's talking about is important. We have to find ways to make sure that our people can grow wealth and can pass that wealth on to generation to come. So those are some of the things that we are looking at, and the Economic Council is in place, and they would have met twice since, and they're going to meet a third time as we put that in place and the strategy of implementation. So I would say that started even before the elections.
Can you say who are some of the members of the council?
Well, once we formalize it, they met twice. We are formalizing it at this time, and then we will make that public.
Right. Staying on the economy, you spoke about the different social programs that you have. You're reinstating the laptop program. You have economic costs paid to students studying abroad. And you're also looking to do other things as well, which you haven't announced as yet. Now, the last time we spoke, I did ask you about whether or not the country will be able to afford that. Now, I'm going to ask you now in the context of the global economy, because one of the things that the local economists pointed out to is that the global economy, the outlook looks grim because of things that are happening on the international stage, the Ukraine war, supply chain challenges, etc., which eventually will have an impact on St. Kitts Nevis. In light of that...
Is having an impact, I should say, yes.
In light of that, are you still confident that the country, financially speaking, will be able to handle all the social programs that you've started and the ones that you intend to start?
Right. So when you look at the social programs, we have to look at the cost, for example, and see if we can absorb the cost of these things. Mm-hmm. For example, I told you to make CFBC free. Yeah. It was $1.5 million per year. That is not a significant cost. Mm-hmm. To add to the economic cost for the students, you'll be surprised that the increase in cost was not that significant either. So these were practical things that I think would have tremendous impact. And the opportunity cost, of course, would lean towards making sure that our people are well-educated and so forth, for example.
Right.
But the reason why I think so is since the government has changed, we have made several chips, and we have had significant discussion about some investments that are to come to St. Kitts and Nevis. And so those investments would have impact, positive impact on the economic situation here in St. Kitts and Nevis. And so we really believe that based on that, we will be able to implement a number of these programs, which we have already started to do already. Mm-hmm. So we are looking at our investment portfolio, and it's looking good thus far. We have started meaningful discussion. We have signed MOUs and so forth, and we'll update the country as these are to be implemented. So I will say that it looks good in terms of the opportunity for investment. It's quite interesting that after the elections, a number of investors came forward. Mm. And they said, Dr. Joe, we had been waiting to invest in St. Kitts and Nevis. And they said, why you didn't do it then? And they said they couldn't do it under the last administration. They wanted to work with an administration that they think would be a more prudent administration.
Did they give reasons for that?
Yeah, I think that they felt like they were under duress in certain circumstances. To be frank. And they think that there might have been too much corruption in the system. And many of them stayed away as a result of that. But now a number of them have come forward. But we have also sought new opportunities, mm-hmm. which we will also use as a means to help to develop our country. So we are looking at that, so they will have more, foreign investment that would help to stir the economy. But not only that, we are getting ready to set up our small business ministry as well, which will give people the opportunity to own their small businesses, and we'll be investing in that. And when people start their own businesses, we have to think about the creativity and innovativeness of our people. Those things will also contribute to stirring the economy. So we know that we are in the middle of the economic issue globally. It is not that it's going to get started. It is that we are in it. We've been through COVID, a war in Ukraine and so forth that has affected supply chain. For example, electricity costs and fuel costs went sky high. But we have found a solution to deal with it. And so we are dealing with it, for example. But we can talk about some of the other things that we would have done. Right. But to say that we are now moving very strongly, we have an economic council, we are moving very strongly on that front to make sure that we receive the necessary investments to continue and to build on what we have here in St. Kitts and Nevis.
Speaking of investments, you were part of the African Caribbean Investment Summit.
Yes, correct. In Barbados
recently, yes. Talk to us about that, because that is very interesting. Well, the event itself was quite interesting.
Yes.
We're seeing where the Caribbean is now trying to make linkages. And I understand that St. Kitts and Nevis is one of the countries that basically signed on to help to create this.
Right. So that was one of the first things that I signed on to as Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my first trips. When I looked at it, you know, based on my own philosophy of life and our people, you know, we are majority people of African descent. We have a connection with Africa, genealogy-wise and otherwise. You know, in the Caribbean, we always talk about having those linkages back to Africa, but they have to be tangible as well. So the Afreximbank is a major bank in Africa that has at least $30 billion, at least $30 billion. And they have reached out to us through connections. And so I traveled to Barbados and we signed on to it. And interestingly enough, one of the first investment opportunities we expect to come from that agreement. And so we are pursuing that. I will not announce it yet, but we are looking at a number of investment opportunities. And to say, when I took that trip, I traveled with the chamber, the president of the chamber. I also traveled with the financial secretary, our minister of foreign affairs and investment, and a PS from my own office. And that, I think, is one of the opportunities that I spoke about, that people are now willing to invest. That is a new opportunity that will directly impact our economy positively.
So if we could just understand the mechanics of this arrangement, is it a case where through this MOU that businesses or investors from Africa will have a chance to invest in countries in the Caribbean, including St. Kitts and Nevis?
Right, with import-export.
Import-export,
we have, we have access to a base of 1 billion people. We have a lot to benefit from. And that is why I said, especially when I spoke at the event where the students were receiving their Taiwanese scholarship, the Republic of China and Taiwan scholarship, I said to them, do not just think about our small island and our small numbers, but think largely. Why not think about exporting whatever you have to a base of 1 billion people? So we have tremendous opportunities. For example, one of the things that was put forward that Ghana was affording, Ghana was saying, we have so much land. Why don't you come to Ghana? Get hundreds of acres of land. Grow what you want and sell it inside of Africa to supply the need. You can come with your money, you will get the land, you develop it, you grow it, and you sell it through that 1 billion.
And the funding will come from the Import-Export Bank.
It can come from the Afrexim Bank. And so you would make the arrangement with them. It gave the opportunity for private firms. Whatever private firm want to take up that opportunity. Suriname is offering an opportunity like that as well. So we know that one of the investments that we would have here with the Afreximbank Bank is to supply Africa. You're talking about 1 billion people and the economy is growing, which means you are expanding the middle class and so forth. So a wider consumer base. And so that would give us opportunity and to make linkages and so forth. So already there are opportunities. If we are innovative enough and creative enough, we can take advantage of these opportunities.
Right. The CBI program,
yes.
How healthy is it right now?
Well, the CBI program, we know that there's a program that started In the early 1980s, it became very...
One of the first countries in the
world. One of the first countries in the world to do it. Mm-hmm. And then we know that in the 2000s, it took on a different life under Labour administration, where it really introduced a lot of wealth into the country and throughout the region, especially the OECS. Mm-hmm. The CBI program has been going through its difficulties as well. But I would say in general, there is some work to be done to make sure that we keep it stable. For example, when I got in, there was information on my desk that we needed to communicate with the Europeans, that I had to quickly pull the team together to make sure that we meet the deadlines and so forth. So that is why I'm saying that the CBI program has been working. There are issues there, and the issues are the market. So I would have to take an opportunity to explain to the people how the market is affecting the CBI program. Because sometimes we might say that if you do the CBI program, the contribution might be maybe $200,000. And then the market is not dictating that you can get that $200,000. So we need, as a country, to understand where we are with the CBI program and to make meaningful decisions so that we can still benefit from it. Mm-hmm. However, we cannot allow it to continue to be the mainstay of our revenue generation. That is what I would say. But going forward with the CBI program, I am now saying, or we are now saying, that the program will now be used to deliver what we need in this country. Our electricity generation, is in the shambles right now. You saw we had to do some load shedding because the generators are old. They had not been replaced for many years. We had to quickly get in there, and we had to buy some new generators. You might have seen that.
Right.
And so we had to quickly do that so that we can stabilize that situation.
And that would have come from from CBI revenue?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily came from tax revenue, but not directly from there. Mm-hmm. The other thing, and I will touch the CBI because it's helping a lot, our water situation is a serious situation as well. And so we are looking at that. So we are looking at electricity generation, and we want to move to renewables such as solar, and other types of natural gas and so forth, which we are looking at already doing. And so that is going in a good direction so far. We also have to invest in water. These are basic things we have to invest in because the country moved ahead with housing and so forth. But electricity generation and water were left behind. So for example, in Keon, my constituency, the constituents have water problem. We are dealing with it. BEED is back in, dealing with that situation. And we are looking at other ways in which we can generate potable water just in case the water that we find. So we have a backup plan for that, but we are dealing with that. So I just wanted to say that there are a number of critical things that need to be invested in our country.
Right.
But the CBI program has been the mainstay, and we have to diversify at this particular time.
And on the issue of diversification, the future of the CBI program, we've heard in recent times that Europeans in particular have expressed concerns about the visa-free access that St. Kitts and Nevis and other countries that have CBI programs in the Caribbean, they have concerns about those countries and about those programs. That could threaten the viability of the program as well.
Yes.
Is that something you're looking at in terms of the long-term nature
of
the program?
Of course. We are looking at that long-term, in the long-term as well. Mm-hmm. As I told you, I met some documentation on my desk in terms of responding to the Europeans, which we did. I brought a committee together, and that committee, we would have put with the CIU that information together so that we can get it to European. And so we're going to keep that committee in place, have a committee in place that overlooks the CBI and to make sure that we do all that we can to keep it afloat. And I know what you speak about the visa-free access, and we don't want to compromise that as well. So we are thinking that there's a middle ground in all of this, and we have to strike it so that the CBI can still be viable for us while we do what is necessary to protect our name as a country and so forth, and the strength of our passport. So we are making sure that we do what we have to do and stay in contact with who we have to stay in contact with to ensure that.
Quickly on the political front.
Yes.
And I will start with this one because this is a major issue. It actually is generating a lot of debate across the Caribbean.
Right.
Since the passing of Queen Elizabeth II, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, there has been a lot of talk about countries moving to become a republic.
Yes.
You know, something you've campaigned on to some extent.
Yes.
Is St. Kitts and Nevis still on that pathway of becoming a republic?
Right. So if you listen to my independence message, I did mention it even in my independence message. I think for any country in our situation in the world today, having gone to independence, the next natural progression is to become a republic. And therefore those discussions should be started. There should be public debate, public consultation, and so forth as we progress on as a country. Because I think that our people would have fought to free themselves of colonialization. And I don't think that that fire of being free after having been slaves for 400 years, that fire has been extinguished. I really think it is still burning and it needs to continue. We need to start the debate, the discussion, mm-hmm. and to move forward to that. But of course, the people should be consulted and involved every step of the way.
What's constitutionally, what's needed for that to happen? Is it a referendum or just a parliamentary majority?
Right. So I think, I have not seen the law specifically on that, but I think based on when you see other countries, but I would like to go to the people. I would like us to take it to the people.
So whether or not yes. you're thinking to take it to the
yeah,
people
I
through
want
a referendum?
Well, even if it's not a referendum, mm-hmm. through at least consultations and lively discussions on it, so that the decision that is made at the end of the day, that is the decision of where the country is at that point in time. But I do see that our people want to get there.
What about persons in the community who, or in the country, who may not be fond of the idea of breaking away from the monarchy, and especially now that we've seen a new transition in the royal family where we now have King Charles, and some people are fond of the royal family and they want to have that connection still with the monarchy?
Right. So, of course, in any issue, you'll have both sides. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I would say that is why we need to take it to the people, right? And the people would have their say on it, and the people will eventually decide. So even those persons who you mentioned, mm-hmm. they would have the opportunity to make their presentation and to be heard as well.
Right. The Labour Party, most political pundits will agree, is in a strong position right now.
Yes.
You've got an overwhelming majority coming into Parliament.
Yes.
After being in opposition for a number
seven
of times,
years.
7 years. In light of that, as a leader of the party,
yes.
what assurance can you give citizens, and especially those who may not have supported the Labour Party,
yes.
That the party will not be in a position or will not abuse its position of strength and power, especially seeing that we may not, we don't know yet, but at least we don't know where the opposition stand at this point in time in terms of the strength of the opposition. And usually mm-hmm. we've seen in democracies when a party is in a very strong position, sometimes there's an abuse of power. So what assurance can you give citizens that that will not be the case with the Labour Party?
Right. If citizens were to just look at our transition in, I think that would, you know, reaffirm our position that we would not abuse power, that we will act as civilized people, as decent people, and honor people, you know, and honor people's humanity and honor their citizenry, okay? And that is our action and not just our words. So they are clear that we as a party, that is not the path that we will follow. We have not done it, even as people are calling for it, some people. And I don't think that they are calling for people to be, they're not calling for the abuse of power or anything like that. They're calling for maybe for quicker action.
Right.
But I would say, based on how we have acted, people can see clearly that we want to do things in a very civilized and respectable manner. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to abuse our power, and we have not abused our power. But at the same time, I would also say that persons should not really seek to abuse the administration either, especially those who know that they're politically appointed and they're given the opportunity to resign. Mm-hmm. And yet you see that some of them are refusing to resign. And that says, so why would you do that? It means then that you might be wanting to abuse the administration because of the goodwill of the administration. So the administration will show some firmness, but it, most importantly, the administration, although it will be firm, it is firm, it will be fair, and it will respect people's constitutional rights.
Right. members of parliament, MPs, you maintained, if I remember serving correct, constituency empowerment.
Yes.
Which was first introduced by the Labour Party administration in 2010. But then it wasn't as robust. No. You know, we didn't see a lot of activity in that area. We find situations where if an opposition MP is in a constituency, not much work is done in that constituency. What can be done, or what will your administration do to ensure that constituency empowerment will be more robust, that whether or not an MP is on the government side, things will get done in that constituency?
Right. So constituency empowerment will be robust, and we will make sure that all constituencies are taken care of. None will be sidelined, whether they have an MP in parliament or not. That will not happen. And therefore, that office must function to move the constituency forward. So I want the people to know that we take that office very seriously, that department very seriously, to make sure that the constituencies get fair development. Not one is lopsided and one is left behind because their MP did not make it into the cabinet. So we will make sure that that is not so. And so the people, again, will speak out during this time of transition. We are putting those things in place as well, so that when we eventually roll out to implement our policies, it will be based on a platform that was well thought out and well put together that would allow a smoother flow as possible of the implementation in all constituencies throughout St. Kitts and Nevis.
What are some of the specific things within constituency empowerment that will ensure this? Because, and you could correct me if I'm wrong,
yes.
I'm not sure if members of parliament, for example, or if they do get any fund from...
Right, our system is not,
set up that way.
Right, and so the department would have officers for each constituency, and those officers will make sure that they carry out the work within that constituency, of course, forming committees and so forth at the constituency level to make sure that what is to be carried out in terms of the policy of the government, that those are carried out in the constituency.
So they'll be working closely with the Member of Parliament in that area then, so to speak?
Or right, they'll be working with
all members of Parliament.
Not just that, they'll be working with the people of the constituency as well. The people of the constituency. Why is it important to take it for the people? For the same reason, you want to make sure that the people are touched and that there is no, you eliminate bias as much as possible there. So the plan is to have those officers work with the people in the constituencies, form committees and so forth, and all the members of the constituency would have an opportunity to have an input into the direction of that constituency.
Finally, two quick things.
Yes.
Finally, constitutional reform. I know
yes.
that is something that's big on your agenda,
yes.
and work has begun in that regard.
Correct.
Can you give us an update on that?
Right. So we will work on constitutional reform. There are a number of things that we are already putting together on the agenda, which we will put forward to the people. I have been in contact with the Premier of Nevis. He and I would have met in person. We have communicated multiple times. We are putting a committee together, for example, to look at where there might be challenges with the relationship between the island of St. Kitts and the island of Nevis so that we can resolve those things. And those would result in some, we think, or there might be some constitutional changes that would be made. Mm-hmm. So there are things in the Constitution that we definitely need to change, and we have started already to put that agenda together. So that agenda is being put together by the AG, his team, our cabinet, and so forth. And as I tell you, we'll form that committee with our counterparts on the island of Nevis, even though we are the federal government, to have that direct communication between the NIA and the federal government so that those constitutional changes will have the input of all, even from that political position, but even to give also an opportunity for political parties to also have an input. For example, you might have a political party that may not be in parliament, but would like to have an input into discussions as to where constitutional reform should go. So they should have an input as well. We'll also have electoral reform, because we know that there are a number of critical things that need to be changed. We saw what took place in that electoral office, but also the boundaries. Look at the boundaries. The boundaries can't be the boundaries of the next elections. We have been talking about boundaries for a very long time now, and we are committed to make sure that we make the boundaries as equal as possible, and of course to make it, to adjust them so that they comply with the policy.
Right. And last time we spoke about the PAP.
Yes.
How much of a priority is that for you? Because I know that you said it needs to be reformed. Both
right. Need to be reformed. So the PAP needs to be reformed. We have found a number of abuses on the PAP. For example, people who qualify couldn't get on, and people who don't qualify are on, and that needs to be adjusted. And we have already started the work with that. With respect to the piece, as I've said before, and what we have found, there were how it was administered, and I will say this, that it was administered almost as if one man controlled everything, and that was Len Harris. We see people work on the piece, no social security were paid for them, the government actually broke the law. And you know, we are putting things in place to make sure that that happened. We don't necessarily have to take any money out of what they get, but we have to make sure that social security is paid for them. In terms of the management of the finance of the peace program, that has been horrible, no accountability. There was a budget of $10 million, and that budget was busted in June. We saw in the peace program that just before the elections, that the numbers exploded on the peace program.
So more than $10 million was being paid out?
Yes, of course. The program is probably about $2 million a month or more, per month. They busted the budget. We can't account for a lot of the money. We know that a lot of the money did not reach the guys who on the program. That money went somewhere else.
So as it stands right now, are any of the members of the program, those who are beneficiaries of the program, are they receiving any monies at this point in time?
Right. We have continued in that end. As we said on the platform, that we were not going to end the program in that way. But we wanted a better program that would better benefit them. Mm-hmm. Right.
On average, how much per month a recipient would get, for example?
Maybe around between $400 to $500 on average.
$400 to $500.
Yeah, right. They would get not per month, per week.
Per week.
Per week. The program is about $2 million per month, about $500,000 a week. But we know that the budget was set at $10 million. That was busted in June, and then about July, between June, July, August, the numbers went from maybe 600 persons on it to about 1,300.
So currently about 1,300.
About 1,300. And then there are persons in the hierarchy in the committee who have said they knew nothing about the numbers exploding that much on the program. So it went from here and it just exploded just before the elections, which tells me that it was used an election gimmick. But I'm concerned about where a lot of the money went. That $10 million was busted quickly, and we know that there were channels where money went. And we have to make sure that has been stopped, but we know the cost of it. So we want to really, we are moving now in the position to create programs, transparent, open programs, where it will give people on the program an opportunity to advance themselves. Some might be interested in going to study. Some might be interested in small businesses. Some might be interested in pursuing other things, but we want these things that are to be pursued. So we want the program to be open, transparent, and so forth, and to make sure that we create a program that our people will be pleased with. Mm-hmm. Of course, that takes time to transition, but what the commitment that we have given is that we will not leave anybody without bread. We will make sure that we put something in place so that the Social Security is paid, and we'll make sure that there are alternative opportunities for the persons on the program.
And the other side of the program are the families who would have suffered at the...
Right, the violence. And so we are also going to look at those children who are left behind as a result of the direct impact of losing predominantly their fathers as a result, so that you can bring some sort of balance to the program.
So they somehow would benefit also from the program as well?
Right, so we are going to see how we are going to set up for them to have some benefit if they're not getting some other benefit. But we said we will look at their situation. Mm-hmm. What we want to create is what you call a Department of Social Protection. That is why we have put the PAP and we have put the STEP, housing, social services and so forth, under one umbrella, aging, under one umbrella called social protection.
Which is by the Deputy Prime Minister.
The Deputy Prime Minister is in charge of. Peace did not go there, because peace is seen as a national security issue. Mm-hmm. So it has, in earnest, remained with me. And so we have kept our commitment that we wouldn't just cut funding and cut off people, but we will seek to see what is taking place. But what I see with the abuse of the funding and how one person basically was the lord over this program was a very sad thing to discover, even though it was suspected.
Right.
So we will make sure that we continue to move the program along in the sense that making it open, transparent, and giving real opportunities to the people who want it, and to stop the abuse. Well, there will be no more abuse because the abuser is no longer in that. And I am saying that, and I mean that. Mm-hmm. It is sad of what was discovered with the peace program to recognize a lot of the money, a significant amount of the money that should have gone to the young men, did not reach them. Did not reach them.
Before we let you go, Prime Minister, and I'm only asking this because
yes.
It is somewhat on the street. You hear people
right.
Shushing, as you say in local terms. What is your relationship like with the former Prime Minister, Dr. Denzel Douglas? He is part of the cabinet, and some people are trying to imagine in their minds being a former leader of the party, former Prime Minister for several years, to serve in the cabinet as a member of the cabinet as opposed to the leader this time around. What, how would you describe your relationship with him?
Well, I would say my relationship with him is a good relationship. We have a very good working relationship as well. He has said multiple times that, you know, he would serve, and I think that he would give the indication, that where he stands now is to help the administration to come in and so forth. So I think those are things in people's minds that they're trying to make bigger than they are. Even during the leadership race, you heard all sorts of things.
Yeah.
After the leadership race, a lot of things. During the campaign, a lot of things. Now I'm in government, still a lot of things.
Which is why I asked the question.
So I think at some point people might reach a conclusion and decision to say, well, it doesn't seem like what we have been saying, all of that has been true.
Mm.
I don't think there's no doubt that I am the Prime Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis. I am the leader of the party. On those things, there are no doubt. That has been accepted by our party, by my cabinet, and so forth, and generally by the people of the country of St. Kitts and Nevis. And, you know, I want to thank Dr. Douglas for the years of contribution that he has given, and he continues to give.
Mm-hmm.
In his position. But this thing that they're looking for and the division that they're looking for to bring down a Labour administration, they couldn't bring us down as a party. They couldn't bring us down when we ran a campaign. They're not going to bring us down now. We are in government. Mm-hmm. We are stable and we are strong. But before we wrap up,
mm-hmm.
I would like to say thanks to my cabinet colleagues. I want to thank the other ministers of government for their hard work. As you can see, we have put a team together. We are women well represented. We have 3 women in cabinet. I think that is the first time in our history we have had 3 women in cabinet as ministers. I think that is in keeping with our campaign commitment as well, that women and youth will get opportunity. As you can see, we have appointed a number. We have started to appoint ambassadors. As you can see, the ambassador to Taiwan is a young man.
Mm-hmm.
He speaks 2 languages, has a master's degree and so forth, well qualified, but he's given the position.
And studied in Taiwan as well.
And studied in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is now His Excellency Dania Francis. And then we have our ambassador to the UN. Is also a fairly young person, mm-hmm. the person of Her Excellency, Ms. Nevis Shivatan. And I think that what you will see is that women will be given the fair opportunity. The youth also will be given their fair opportunity so that we can bring a government in place where people can see themselves in it. And so I'm very, very proud of that. And I'm very, very proud of the work that the team has been doing thus far. As you can see, and as we have said, this is not a one-man show. This is a team, and we intend to govern as that. Even though I am the captain of the team, I can't do it alone. And I do respect that. And the thing about the team is that as they go into the different ministries, these people are very accomplished in their various areas. And that is making the work easier as well. And so we are transitioning well and transitioning smoothly. And the pace will pick up because first we wanted to get the idea planned, give people the honorable, give them the space to do the honorable thing and so forth. And so that we wanted to act decently. So I'm pleased that we have done a number of significant things, and we'll make sure that the administration entrench itself to deliver for the people of St. Kitts
You have been listening to Let's Talk St. Kitts Nevis here on Voice of the Caribbean Radio at voiceofthecaribbean.net. That interview with Dr. Terence Drew, the Prime Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis. And that will do it for this edition of Let's Talk St. Kitts Nevis right here on Voice of the Caribbean Radio at voiceofthecaribbean.net, reaching the Caribbean and beyond. Stay tuned.